stage, and we'll start recording. This is Robert Tidwell on the 24th of August, 2007, conducting a telephone interview with Lawrence J. Riley, Sr., who was chief aboard the USS Frankie Evans during the time of its collision in June of 1969. Mr. Riley, how do you want me to address you? Do you want me to address you as Chief Riley, Mr. Riley?
Yeah, Chief's all right.
Okay. Let's begin with your background. Where were you born? When were you born?
Okay, I was born in Brooklyn, New York, on the 18th of June, 1924. Lived in the city there until 1942 when I went in the Navy.
Okay. Were you an only child?
No, I had a sister. She's still around. She's part of the reunion group there, Sister Dorothy.
Okay. Oh, yes, that's right. She's a nun.
Yep.
Okay. What order?
Daughters of Wisdom.
Okay. Okay. Is she your older sister or younger sister?
She's younger.
Younger sister. Okay. So you lived in Brooklyn all the way till the time that you joined the Navy?
Brooklyn and Queens, in the city.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, until November of 42.
Okay. And when you went into the Navy, did you choose the Navy, or, as they say, did the Navy choose you?
Yeah, no, I chose the Navy. I figured I was going to be drafted probably in early 43, so I didn't want to go in the Army. I always did like the Navy, so.
Okay.
I picked the Navy.
Where did you go through boot?
Excuse me?
Where did you go through boot camp?
Newport, Rhode Island.
Okay, that's not too far away.
Yeah, no. No, in fact, it was at Coasters Island, and the old Barracks B, and right there by the War College.
Okay.
Yeah. We were some of the last ones to go through boots there.
Oh, wow. Well, it must have made it a little bit easier for you whenever you did have some time away that you could actually go home and visit family and friends then.
Yeah, it wasn't too bad. I think it was 6 or 8 weeks there in recruit training. Then I went to torpedo school at Coasters. That was on Coasters Island also.
Okay.
I left there in early 43 to go aboard the Oakland.
Okay. Let's see, Oakland. That's a cruiser, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a light AA cruiser.
Okay.
CL-95.
Okay. And where did you serve aboard Oakland?
We were in the Pacific the whole time.
Okay.
In fact, I spent almost 5 years on her. I didn't leave the Oakland until January of 48.
Oh, wow. Okay. So your whole time aboard the Oakland, were you a torpedo man? Or?
No, that's a little funny story. There.
Okay.
I was in a torpedo gang when I went aboard the Oakland. I was the smallest guy in the gang.
Okay.
And I was the only one to fit in the tubes, clean the grease out of the tubes. We were on shakedown cruise, and I had just finished diving the tubes, as they call it, and all covered with grease and whatever, and I'd come out there, and I was kind of cussing and swearing a little bit, and on the 01 level, right above the torpedo tubes, there was an old chief up there, and he had hash marks from his cuff to his shoulder. He was brought back in temporarily to help with the shakedown cruises of the ships, so he called down, he says, "Hey, young man, come up here." And I figured, well, this is it. He heard me bitching, and he was going to be all over me. So he said, what seems to be the problem? I said, well, I'm the smallest guy in the torpedo gang, and every time the tubes have to be dived, I'm the guy that has to do it. I said, it gets kind of old after a while. And he turned around. He said, okay, how would you like to go in the gun gang? I said, fine. So he transferred me from the Fox Division to the 4th Division right then. And I started out as a gunner's mate.
Okay. On what, the main batteries or one of the secondary?
No, I started out on the 20 millimeters.
Okay.
I was on them for a couple of years, and then by the time I got off the Oakland, I had been on all of them, and 5-inch. I was on a 5-inch when I left.
Okay. Oh, wow. So once you left the Oakland, then where did you go?
Excuse me?
Where did you go after the Oakland?
I went on board a destroyer minesweeper, the Davison DMS 37. It was a converted 1650 destroyer.
Okay.
And we went on a just on a Westpac cruise and on the A-bomb test, one of the A-bomb tests, we had to be out there monitoring something or other. I don't know, even know what we were doing. But anyway, then we came back in, and I left the Navy in November of 48, and then went back in the reserve in 1956.
Okay.
Friends of mine had started a fleet division in the Bronx, and they were operating on whatever destroyer would be in port, or the DE, which would be in port on a weekend. And it was a weekend deal. You know, you
okay.
Deal for the weekend every one weekend a month, and then two weeks a year you went on your active duty. So I stayed in that until on the USS DeLong, DE-684. And then I left her, and I went, shipped over USN again in 65.
Okay.
I shipped over again to the regular Navy, and I went to Special Weapons School from there in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Yeah.
Golly, it.
Yeah, well, that's where they had all the day bomb tests and all. That's what we were going to school.
Okay.
I made senior chief before I left the ship, so I went out there as senior chief.
Okay, so now that makes sense. Now that you said that it was part of an atomic weapons school, because otherwise I was thinking you're in the Navy and you're going out into. Well, it just struck me as kind of odd or almost a little funny that you know, you're in the Navy and they send you out about as far away from water as you can get
in the
continental United States.
Yeah, well, that was basically, that's it, it was a school, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, you said that when you were in the 40s that the destroyer minesweeper you were on had participated in atomic bomb test. Now, did you actually see any of this?
Excuse me?
Did you actually see any of the atomic bomb?
No, we were 400 miles away.
Okay.
And we were supposed to be monitoring the, clouds and stuff like that.
Okay.
Sending up weather balloons every day and different things like that.
Now, what were you doing on the destroyer at that time, that destroyer minesweeper?
Well, I was the leading gunner's mate on the ship.
And okay.
We had 5-inch, and they had taken off the 40s and the 20s, so all we had was the 5-inch, and we had a variable depth sonar.
Okay.
There that they were experimenting with. That was part of our responsibility.
Okay. And then when you left the Navy at that time, I believe you said it was 48.
Yep.
What did you do then?
Oh, various and sundry. I was mainly in, 49, my father-in-law had owned a hotel in the Thousand Islands Hotel, Resort Hotel. We went up there for 1949, and then there was a serious explosion up there in town, and kind of wrecked the hotel, and that put us out of business. So after that, I was in construction most of the time, carpentry and roofing.
Okay. So then you go back into the Navy and reserves, and then you said you then made the transition back.
I'm not hearing it too well.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. So then after you'd spent some time in the reserves, then you made the transition back into the regular Navy.
Right.
Okay. And then what were you doing then?
Well, after I finished the special weapons school, I went aboard the Kearsarge. I was in the W Division on the Kearsarge special weapons. And while I was there, funny enough, I ended up working on torpedoes too while I was on a Kearsarge. And then,
hopefully not going in the tubes.
Huh?
Hopefully they didn't have you going down the tubes again.
No. We worked in the shop. We set. They were running a big survey. I can't think of Admiral's name now. He was pretty famous in the Navy. He was the only submarine skipper that sunk a Japanese battleship with a torpedo anyway. He was running a survey, and we were firing a whole bunch of fish, some live and some practice fish out there, getting information on how they acted and different depths of the water and the salinity and the temperatures and all that stuff, how it would affect the torpedoes.
Okay.
And we did that for almost 6 months, I guess.
Okay. So when you went into the Navy first time in reserves and then transitioning back into the regular Navy,
yep.
you were already married at that time?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was married in January of 45.
Okay. And where did you meet your wife?
Where
did you meet your wife?
She's from the neighborhood.
Okay.
I moved into the neighborhood in 1938, and I was still there when I went in the Navy in 42.
Okay.
So that was my home of record when I joined the Navy, Ozone Park, New York.
And how many children did you have?
We had five.
Wow.
My oldest one graduated from West Point and ended up with a Navy commission. My second son was the one we lost on the Evans.
Okay.
And then I had another son and two daughters that were home.
Okay. So then how long were you on the Kearsarge?
About 3 years. Then I went from the Kearsarge to the Evans.
Okay. I find that interesting because the Kearsarge was in Operation Sea Spirit.
Was what?
Was in the naval training exercise.
Yeah.
And I just find it interesting that.
Well, that it was because as soon as after the accident, I was picked up by a motor launch from the Australian ship, and then they transferred me to the Kearsarge. And I knew everybody on the Kearsarge at the time, so I was able to get. I just stayed there a short while, and they put me on a plane back to the States because I had lost my son. I wanted to get home, and so all the rest of the crew stayed there though for the final hearing and all of that stuff.
Okay,
but I got back first.
Okay, so your second son. The one who you had lost in the collision.
Yeah.
How old was he when he went into the Navy?
He was about to turn 21. He was on a kiddie cruise.
Okay.
He was just finishing up. He would have been, that week got sunk in June. His birthday was in September, so he would have been getting out on the end of a kiddie cruise in September.
Okay. So how long had he been in at that time?
Well, he's had 3 years, whatever.
Okay. Okay, and what prompted him to join the Navy? Did he just want to follow in your footsteps?
It's kind of, my oldest son tried to get in the Navy, and he applied for Annapolis, and they said, well, you're colorblind, so you can't do that. So he went and he tried. He got in West Point, so all the time he's in West Point, he found out that seeing as though I was in the Navy, it still had the rule in effect that would allow him to transfer to the Navy upon graduation from West Point. And so we talked about that, and my other son wanted to get in the Navy anyway, and he liked engineering and stuff like that, so he got in. He was a boiler technician in the Navy.
Okay. So where did he go through boot?
Excuse me?
Where did he go through boot camp?
San Diego.
Okay. Okay. So, I want to know where you were at the time of the collision, what you were doing at the time.
Where, what, yeah, I didn't get that.
Oh, I'm sorry. where were you during the night of the collision?
Okay. Just prior to the collision, we had a couple of more people made chiefs, so we had more chiefs than we had bunks in the chief's quarters.
Okay.
And the captain said, take the two senior chiefs and put them in the stateroom on the main deck opposite the XO stateroom.
Okay.
On those destroyers, the normally it would have been in that, I guess the navigator would be up there opposite the XO. And he put Chief Wright, who was a master chief machinist, and myself, they gave us that stateroom up there. So I was in the stateroom when we got hit.
Okay. And at this time, what was your rate?
At that time, I was senior chief gunner's mate.
Okay. Okay. So, since you were senior chief gunner's mate, you must have some kind of recollection of the time that the Evans was spending on the gun line.
What?
You must have memories of when the Evans was on the gun line then.
Oh yeah, sure.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. we shot a lot of rounds on the gun line, and in fact one time we had a shoot there. I was always up and around when the guns were shooting. They were shooting H&I fire and some shore bombardment. I stayed up. I was up for 37, 38 hours straight or something like that. And when I woke up, it was in the chief's quarters. We were using the forward mounts for the bombardment, and all the empty breasts would end up in the chief's quarters. And that empty breast was 4 foot deep in that chief's quarters when I woke up. And the mess cook said, I don't know how you slept through. They said that breast was bouncing down there. You kept right on sleeping, because I hadn't been asleep in 3 days or 2.5 days. So I guess I must have been pretty tired.
I imagine so. Well, and from the research that I've done, I know that the Evans was on the gun line just shortly before going into this naval exercise.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And y'all spent, I think it was from the 15th of May to about the 20th or so?
Till the 20 what?
Till about the 20th.
Yeah, okay. That sounds right, because we were in Manila Bay when we picked up the draft new sailors there, I think, and I believe I had to watch, I believe it was the 28th of May.
Okay.
So that sounds pretty good.
If you don't mind, returning to the gun line,
yeah.
What was that like?
I don't know. It was not like a World War II experience, because nobody was shooting back at us, but it was mostly every night, and we shot up quite a bit of ammunition, and then we would go alongside one of the ships and rearm and refuel and whatever we had to do. Sometimes we did that at night too in the dark. So it was pretty hectic for a while, especially with the young crew. The basic crew of the Evans were, very few of them were World War II. And myself and a few others were only from World War II that had any experience, really. And there was a few from Korea, but there wasn't that many on a ship that had that much experience in shooting the 5-inch, because we didn't have anything else to shoot. So that was pretty busy, though.
I imagine so. What were your normal duties when you were on the gun line?
Well, just to make sure if anything happened on the guns, I had to be right there.
Okay.
I was kind of like a roving maintenance man, you might call me. I was a senior gunner's mate aboard, so that was my job to make sure they kept working. If they broke down, we fix them and get them shooting again. In fact, at that time, we had one gun mount that was down, because we had a bad power drive in one, but we were using the two forward mounts. So, we were busy all the time with that stuff, and that fire, that H&I fire, and that shore bombardment, and then of course you had a rearm, all that stuff was done at sea, sometimes at night. It's not the best operation around, but we had a pretty good crew there. I was really proud of that whole crew right from that day one, because as soon as we got out there and started shooting, they were right there. That we never had any problem with anybody.
Okay. So you said that the power drive had gone out on one of the mounts. What is that used for?
Well, they have hydraulic power drives on them, and we had one that went down. We were waiting for. They had a special team of people that they used to fly all around the fleet when you had a problem. We couldn't fix it by ourselves. They had to bring in special parts or something. I forget what the story was. But anyway, they had a special crew supposed to be coming aboard to fix it, and they never did. They never did fix it, actually. When we went in the yard, that power drive was still down. We ended up getting new gun mount. So it was down for quite a while.
So the power drive, is this used to traverse the...
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Train and elevation.
Okay.
And other than that, you can still do it manual, you know, but for sure bombardment there, they were always using radar control and Mark 37 directors, and so a manual is kind of tough to keep matching up pointers.
Okay.
Much better than automatic.
Yeah, a lot less stress on the gun crew too.
Oh yeah. Yeah, no, it was a pretty good all around crew. The fire controlman and the radar man and all those people all worked very close together. It was a good ship.
Okay. Well, from what I've read, it certainly was. So, when you received these orders, or at least when the ship received orders that it was going to participate in this exercise,
yeah,
you then went to Manila Bay, yes?
Yeah, we picked up... Oh, man, I'm trying to think of how big the draft was. It was a big draft because we left the States. We were shorthanded.
Okay.
And then we had some problems, but we got into Japan. They took a few more people off the ship, and we were shorthanded quite a bit. I remember the captain saying he sent a message that he would be hard driven to operate on a gun line unless he got some additional personnel to fill the empty slots. And then in Manila Bay, that draft that came aboard, they were all fresh out of boots. In fact, I don't even think they had a boot leave. They graduated boot camp, and they shipped them right out to us. I believe it was 38 people in that draft. And, of course, most of that 38 ended up in the 74 that we lost. Of course, most of them were in the 1st Division, and we lost just about the whole 1st Division in the collision. Some of them were only in the Navy a few months. That was kind of sad, but that's the way it goes, I guess.
Yes, in fact, one of those was James Kerr.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember talking to his mother and sister. And they said that he had only been in the Navy just a very short time before he was sent off to the Evans.
Yeah, they couldn't have been in boot camp. I think boot camp maybe in those days was like maybe 10 weeks. I'm not sure. And they went directly from boot camp. They put them on a plane and flew them out to us to the ship. And they got there on the 28th of May. And 4 days later, we got sunk. So you know, it's a pretty tough deal for new kids, because, you know, new kids on the ship, too, they didn't know their way around. They didn't know right side up or the bottom side down or anything else about the ship. The rest of us who'd been on the ship for a while had a feel for it, and we knew what we could do, even in the dark. But these kids, they were trapped in that 1st Division compartment, and that was it. We lost them, and we lost, I think, all our junior officers that we lost, too, were forward there, too. right, they were right above that first division compartment, right below where I slept. I was on the main deck, and the junior officers were one deck down, and the first division was also one deck down from the mess hall. So it was all those people in that forward section that we lost.
Okay, so your quarters were in the forward section then?
Yeah, we were okay. We were just forward of where we got hit. When after we got hit, we Chief Wright, Master Chief Wright, myself, got out. We got out of our when we got out of our, the stateroom, we was standing on the bulkhead. The deck was already vertical then, and we were standing on a bulkhead, which was the bulkhead of the XO's stateroom. And we went from there into the wardroom, and somebody had opened a hatch for us. So they didn't know it was us, but they'd opened a hatch anyway. And we got out through the wardroom, and while we were getting out, we were talking, and the XO called us. I don't quite remember, but anyway, I seem to recall saying, XO, we're in a wardroom, something to that effect. And but he was the only other one that we heard or talked to or whatever until we got in the water.
Wow, so you were in the forward section at the time of the collision?
Yeah, it was just by, well, if you're familiar with the ship, it just hit us aft of the forward stack.
Mm-hmm, yes.
So that, you know, that took out CIC and combat and sonar and everything else and the captain's sea cabin. And I don't know, the captain never did find out how he got down below. He ended up going off the ships around the main deck, but he don't even know how he got down there. So I don't know whether he just fell through the ship or got hit or what happened. But we got hit was his after bulkhead of his sea cabin was part of the place, part of the ship that left. So
during that night, what were you doing?
Before that?
Yes.
Well, we were on an exercise.
Sure.
And they divided the group up into two groups, and one group was supposedly attacking the other group, and we were up until about 3 o'clock in the morning. We had a very successful operation, and it was about 3 o'clock in the morning when we secured that operation. I take that back. Probably was closer to midnight when we secured the operation, but they were saying it was a good operation. And then, of course, we got hit at 3:15. So everything from there on in was early morning.
So were you still awake at the time of the collision?
No, I was not. I woke up standing on the I woke up standing on the bulkhead.
Oh, wow!
And that's kind of an odd feeling. You look around. There was a hole. There was a porthole in our stateroom where we slept, and that porthole got knocked out or smashed out in any way. The water was pouring in there. That's mainly where I saw the water coming into the forward part of the ship, was right there. And by the time we went through the wardroom, we actually swam through the wardroom to get to the door and the after bulkhead of the wardroom. And that's how we got out after the door on the main deck in and out.
So how is it that your son came to serve aboard the Evans? So how is it that your son came to serve aboard the Evans?
Oh, well, we had talked about it for a long time. We had the paperwork in for about a year, and they kept sending him all. He was on a tanker on the East Coast someplace, and then they finally shipped him out to Subic Bay. From Subic, they put him on another destroyer that was operating out of Subic, and I ended up going from the Evans over to Subic and then from Subic to the ship he was on, and spoke to his XO and said, hey, he's got orders to come on the Evans, you know, when are you going to let him go? So then they let him go, and we flew back to the Evans then.
So what was his rate aboard Evans?
What was that?
What was his rate aboard Evans?
He was a boiler tender third class. He just made third class. They carried him on a list, though, and I never did get that straight. I tried to get that changed, and on the list of people that we lost, they had him as a fireman, and they had King, who was supposed to make first class. They had him. They had him as first class, but he had made chief the April prior to us getting sunk, and I never could get that changed. I called different people and said, "Hey, that's not right. You know, King was a chief. My son was a BT-3. I think there was another one. There was a seaman in there that was a yeoman or something, and they carried him as a seaman. And we never, I don't know if they ever got it straight. At the last list I saw, they still had it wrong, so I gave up trying to get it straight.
So what did your son do as a boiler tender?
He was in the fire room tending the boilers. He was on watch when we got hit. In fact, he normally would have been in the after fire room. And for some reason that night, during the exercise, the chief changed him around, took him out of the after fire room and put him in the forward fire room. And he was standing watch in the forward fire room when we got hit. He was, according to Chief McKeon, who was the senior BT chief, he was talking to my son when we got hit. Some kind of report about something or other. Anyway, he was the last one that spoke to my son, Chief McKeon.
Oh, wow. So, I'm sorry, well, you were asleep at the time, so I was going to ask if you had any kind of hint you said that you were asleep at the time, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So, when the collision occurs, and, you know, you came to standing on a bulkhead, what was your first thought? What did you think may have happened?
You know, I really didn't know. I didn't hear any collision alarms or anything, and the first thing that came to my mind when we got outside the ship, we got outside the hull, I looked out there, and the main condenser from the engineering spaces was the big globular piece of equipment, and it was painted white. It was a bright moonlight night that night, and the moonlight was shining on this big white object out there. And I was thinking maybe we had a astronauts or something down in the water. I didn't know what the heck it was, really, to tell you the truth. And we of course, once we hit the water, we could see the forward part of the ship sunk, and it's just a matter of really seconds, really. And the after part of the ship, the kind of slewed around and got it alongside the carrier there, the Australian carrier. They had it tied up alongside the carrier, so I didn't see that. We thought the whole ship was gone there for a while because we didn't see the after part that had swung around, and the carrier was on the far side of the carrier. We thought the whole ship was gone, and then we found out that it was just the forward section.
So what were your initial thoughts or reactions when you learned that it was a collision?
Oh, boy. It's hard to say. Of course, I was wondering. I right away thought about my son, but then normally he would have been in the after part of the ship. And then when they told us the after part was okay, I said, well, I figured he probably was okay. But then I found out from his chief after we got aboard the carrier, I found out from his chief that he had been transferred up forward, and he was actually in the forward fire room when we got hit. So that kind of answered up my question about my son. So,
you then said that you had been transferred over to the Kearsarge.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Yeah, that transferred over there, and they had a card flight going out to Subic Bay, and I got on the card, and I got over to Subic Bay. From Subic Bay, they took me over to, it was the old Air Force Base in Manila. I can't think of the name of it anyway.
Clark?
Which?
Was it Clark?
Maybe it was Clark. It might have been Clark, but anyway, I sat there for 26 hours. Just didn't have priority. They kept having planes, and a couple of times I got a seat, and then I was bumped, and then couldn't get out. And finally, about 26 hours after I got there, I finally was able to get on a flight. One time I was bumped by a computer. So I figured, well, I don't know what they're going to do with the computer, but I don't know if I could have filled its shoes. I guess I couldn't.
So you said that you asked for permission to return to the States.
Excuse me?
You said that you had asked for permission to return to the States.
Yeah, right.
Okay. And how did that go? Did they honor that
pretty
quick?
That was funny. Not really funny, but it was kind of awkward. In the first place, I didn't have... when I went aboard the Kearsarge, one of the chiefs gave me a set of khakis, and they got me a pair of shoes and a few things like that, and a towel and some shaving gear. And when I left Clark... we flew into Hawaii, and we got into Hawaii, and of course I had been hot, sitting in Clark there for 20 some odd hours, sweating, my khakis didn't look very good, and I was sitting in Hawaii waiting for, we actually ended up going back on a Pan Am flight, I think it was, and I was sitting in the waiting room there, and the lieutenant commander come up to me, and he said, Chief, he says, I think that it's about time you got cleaned up and changed your uniform. And I looked a mess, I know. So I said, well, I said, I would if I had a uniform. And I told him what the story was. And he said, oh, okay. He said, I just came from down below. And he said, I saw there's a lot of newspaper down there. He said, I didn't know who they were looking for. They must be looking for you. So he made arrangements to go down some other way and go the back way and get in the plane so I could avoid these newsmen, but we didn't avoid them anyway. They had everything covered.
Oh, wow.
So they were there when we had to get in the plane. We had to practically fight our way through the newsmen to get on the plane and get out of there. Then we got back to the States. My son, who was, he was a lieutenant then, he was a public affairs officer. He had things under control pretty much in Travis Air Force Base. We flew into Travis, and when we got there, Travis. We flew into Travis, and they took us from Travis by car to Oakland to catch a flight from, I lived in Orange County at the time, California, so they flew us into, they had a flight going out of Oakland down to Orange County, and, to LAX, I'm sorry, to Los Angeles. And the guy that drove the car was a yeoman. I'll tell you, it's a wonder he didn't get a ticket, because when we got in our car, somebody said, you know, we only have 55 minutes to catch the plane, and here we are sitting at Travis Air Force Base, and we have to get to Oakland. And somehow this kid made it. I don't know how he did. It was quite a wild ride. But we made that plane, and we went. Got into LAX, and then from LAX, my youngest son met me there, and we drove home then from there.
Okay.
So, it wasn't a very good trip, but.
So when did you get the official word that your son was among the 74?
Oh, well, we actually got the word from the newspaper man from the Long Beach newspaper, and how we got it from him. My son knew him, being a public affairs officer. They had worked with each other on different stories about the Evans and whatever. And I couldn't get the official word from anyone. But he called his friend. He heard that this newspaper man had the list, actually, of who was lost. My son Jim called him, and he verified that Larry was lost. So that's the way we got it. It wasn't until quite a number of days later that a lieutenant commander and his wife showed up at our house and talked to my wife. And then we got it in writing after a while. You know, we sent us a copy of the messages and different things like that. But that was a few days.
So when you learned from your son's friend that Lawrence had been lost, what was your reaction?
hard to say. I mean, it's quite a loss when you lose a son or a daughter, but I don't know. I really don't know. I was a little upset at the time because they didn't notify my wife in the right way, and you know, we had to go through the back doors to find out about it. And we kind of got the runaround there for a while, and I wasn't too happy about that. We lost them. We lost them, and we didn't know whose fault it was or anything else until afterwards. But I don't know. You know, I spent so many years in the Navy and so many years doing things like that that, you know, I know accidents happen, and you know, there's not much you can do about it. Really, it doesn't do any good to cry about it after it's over. But.
So how did your wife and kids handle the news?
Pretty good. My son had a wife and a child. My grandson was a year old. Yeah, he was a little over a year old when the ship got sunk, and she took it pretty hard. We had some problems with her, but they finally straightened out. But they set up a college fund for the sons of the ones that were lost, which was a pretty good deal. The Australians set that up.
Okay.
And that was here in the States, and when the surviving children turned of age, then they got a piece of the fund that was there, the Evans Fund. Other than that, there wasn't a heck of a lot. I had a son who was a public affairs officer. He was an officer. He took care of most of the legal stuff and whatever had to be done, you know, on the stateside. And I was glad we had him because he got some answers on some stuff that we couldn't get other than ourselves. I don't know. He was in Charleston. My oldest son was in Charleston when we got hit, and he managed to get transferred out to Long Beach to the public affairs office there. So we had him there in Long Beach, and then after I got back, I received orders for the Naval Reserve Training Center outside of Los Angeles there, which I went to, and I was there about only about 6 months, and we got a letter that they were closing it down. So then I had to find someplace else to go. So I went home, and I sat down and started to figure out all the closest naval facilities to where I lived. And first one I found was 6 miles from my house in Santa Ana, Santa Ana Naval Reserve Training Center. So I went over there, and I went in to see the captain. It was Captain Mildorn. And I said, "Captain, I'm looking for a place to hang my hat." I said, "My ship got sunk, and the place that they sent me to now is closing down. They have no orders for me. Do you have any openings here at the training center?" And he said, "Geez, I don't think so." So I left and went home. In the meantime, the yeoman there had heard us talking, and he went in and saw the captain. Said, "Captain, our senior chief is waiting for relief because he's being transferred." So the captain said, "Well, Chief Riley is a master chief, and the other fellow was a senior chief." He said, "Well, call the bureau and find out if we can make the swap." So they called the bureau, and about an hour after I got home, the yeoman called me and said, "Come on back over here. We got your billet." They got it cleared through the bureau, so I ended up stationed at Santa Ana Naval Reserve Center. I was there for a while, and then from there, well, we received a message. "The following personnel are, it's requested the following personnel, how the heck was it worded? Requested the following personnel volunteer for additional duty in Vietnam." and my name was on the list. So the captain called up Washington, and he said, look, he said, the chief just got back. His ship was sunk. He lost his son. He closed down the other station he was supposed to go to, and so on and so forth. And I think you ought to change his orders. So they said, okay. They changed my orders. Well, they canceled that. He said, okay, ignore that message. Then about a month later, here came the same message again, and it said the following personnel will report for temporary additional duty in Vietnam. So I'm gone. I got off the plane in Subic Bay, and there was a Master Chief Gunner's Mate there, Black, that I'd known for years in the Navy. He was checking off the people getting off the plane. He said, what the hell are you doing here? I said, I don't know. I said, what I'm doing here. I said, I got orders to come here. And he knew that the ship had been sunk and all. And he said, well, he said, I think maybe I can get you a decent billet so you don't have to go in country anyway. So we went over to the ammunition depot, and he spoke to the skipper over there, and I ended up at the Naval Ammunition Depot in Subic there for a tour of duty about 3 months, I guess. And then back to the States. Then I had orders for the Samuel Gompers. So I retired from the Samuel Gompers, the destroyer tender.
Okay.
That was about it.
So what were you doing at the Naval Reserve Training Center? So what did you do at the Naval Reserve Training Center?
Oh, I was a senior chief, you know, instructing the reservists mainly, and then we had 11 people stationed there. Different rates.
Okay.
And, you know, the reserves met once a week, and you had classes for them and drills and whatever. Took care of some personal problems for the troops. The kids would get themselves in a little bit of trouble, and it was up to the old chief to try to get them out of it. I enjoyed working with them.
So when you were aboard the Samuel Gompers, what was your rate there?
I went aboard there in the 5th Division at Samuel Gompers. We took care of all weapons, 5-inch guns and whatever, and all optical stuff. We took care of computers, typewriters. I had 7 different shops. I was a senior chief. The ships came alongside the Gompers. The destroyers came alongside, and they would have a long list of stuff they needed repaired. And as I say, we had, I had the gauges, the gauge shop, the typewriter shop, the gun shop. I'm trying to think of what they all were now, but anyway. And we would send out different crews to work on a destroyer and help them get their problems squared away. That was pretty good duty. I didn't mind that too much.
Okay.
Then I retired from the Gompers then.
Okay, and what year was that?
Excuse me?
What year did you retire?
1974.
Okay. When you served aboard the Gompers, where did it operate?
Well, we were mainly in the States. Then we left and we went to Kaohsiung, China.
Okay.
We were in Kaohsiung, China when I retired. I left the ship in Kaohsiung.
Okay.
Went back to the States, to San Diego, to retire.
So what did you do after you retired from the Navy?
I went to work for a wire and cable company in Los Angeles. My son had worked for them before, and I had done some work for them, and some carpentry work and construction work for them. And I went to work when I was the supervisor of he had 2 buildings, two big warehouses, and I was responsible for stocking the warehouses, getting the orders out, and things like that. I did that for about 2 years, and then they folded, and then after that I was just on my own doing custom carpentry, cabinet work, and stuff like that.
Okay. With respect to the collision, did you did you keep up with the any of the news reports on the court martial and the trial?
Did we keep up with what?
Did you keep up with the court martial and the trial?
No, not really. I ended up getting I had a copy of the findings from that hearing, that final hearing, which is now in Texas Tech there someplace. But no, I didn't really follow up too much on it. No, I was invited to a number of ceremonies honoring the Evans and the 74 that we lost. I went to a couple of number of them around Los Angeles, Long Beach area, and but other than that, no. I wasn't in touch with too many of the survivors either. A few of them I sent Christmas cards back and forth, and then of course they passed away and whatever. And then I stumbled on the first reunion, quite by mistake. Somebody called me up and said, "Hey, we saw something in the paper about Evans having a reunion in Virginia." I didn't know anything about it, so I called them up, and then my wife and I went to that one, and we went to a few of the reunions, but haven't been able to make a hold of them.
Okay. Were you injured in any way during the collision?
Yeah, I had a little bruise in my back, but okay. I got checked into the hospital at Subic, and they looked at it, and they said it was okay, and that was it. No, I didn't have anything major. I had a bruise.
Well, that's very fortunate.
Yeah. That's funny, too. You know, little things happen sometimes on the lighter side, even during a disaster like that. When I jumped off the ship into the water, there was a piece of the deck grating from the bridge floating around there, you know, the wooden deck they had on the bridge. And so I was hanging on to that, and there was three or four of us hanging on to there, and one of the other chiefs, the chief quartermaster, who was a beautiful, good swimmer. I mean, he was a top-notch swimmer. And he comes swimming from somewhere other direction, and he came alongside, and I called him. I said, "Hey, come on, hang on here." You know, we knew that the boats were in the water picking us up, and the helicopter were picking people up. So he came over, and as he came over to hang on to the deck grating with us, his foot scraped down the back of my leg with his toenail. And boy, the thing that came to my mind was sharks. Oh man, it just scared the hell out of me, but it was him. we were lucky there. So yeah, no, we had I didn't have any real damage, and had to wash the fuel oil office, the bunker oil office, but they treated us good on the Australian ship there, and we weren't on there very long. We were just on there long enough to get a change, to get a shower and get cleaned up and checked into sick bay, and then they transferred us over to the Kearsarge. So then from the Kearsarge was on the way home.
And one of the things that I had read was that the Australians had opened the beer locker.
They did. That they did do. You know, it's funny, we had dealt with some of those Australians. It was funny, though. One of the Australian destroyers that was with us on the operation, we had swapped people. We took some of their people on our ship, and some of our people went over to their ship, you know. And that was the big talk. Oh, boy, we went aboard that Australian ship, and they had beer, and they had this, and, you know, because we never had any on the ship. But they did, when they picked us up, they had all of that stuff available if we wanted it. No, they were good. I got pretty friendly with one fellow there. I still hear from him once in a while. He goes to the reunions, and you know, I had really nothing. The only thing that the whole situation was the way, the lack of reporting it to the survivors, to the wives, and all the way they did it or didn't do it. It was kind of mishandled in a way, and I know at the time, my son wasn't very happy about it. He was a public affairs officer. He wrote an article that went in one of the naval magazines. I forget what it was. outlining the whole thing, how he thought it should have been handled. He got himself in a bit of trouble writing that article, but he was going to be damned to be good if he wasn't going to write it and say somebody goofed up and should have done it better. But you know, in those times, so many, it was all in the Long Beach area, all the survivors, and I mean all the families, and to get 74, 70, whatever it was, casualty control officers within a day and get them out and make a report to go notifying the families. I know it's pretty tough. Because later on, when I was at the Naval Reserve Center, I was assistant to the skipper on a casualty control, and we had to go on the people that were being killed in Vietnam, and we had to go notify their families and all. And that was not an easy situation or an easy thing to do. And to try to organize 70-some-odd of them all at one time, yeah, I guess the Naval District had their hands full.
Oh, I imagine so.
Yeah.
How long was it before your wife knew that you were okay?
Geez, I don't know. Hey, hon, how many days after the collision was it that those people showed up to notify you, that lieutenant commander and his wife? About two, three. I know it wasn't right away. Probably two or three days, but anyway, it was a while.
I imagine she was pretty worried.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, the beginning was they didn't know if either my son or I were lost. So, they, you know, that was up in the air. Then the word came out that there was one. And first thought it was me, and then turned out it was my son, so... It was kind of messed up. I found a friend of mine whose cousin was a lieutenant in the Air Force out there in Clark. They got in touch. I got in touch with him, and he got in touch with a friend of mine. And my friend of mine was the one that gave my wife the final word, I guess, or the family the final word on who it was that was lost. But they also tried to get me out of Clark, and he had his colonel or whatever he was in charge of the Air Force over there. He couldn't get me out of there either. So I went to his house for dinner and took a shower and cleaned up one night before I left there. That's about the only contact I had with anybody other than that lieutenant commander in Hawaii who tried to get me past the news people.
Yeah, that was good of him to do that.
Huh?
And that was good of him to do that.
Oh yeah, yeah. And you know, it's funny. He felt bad because he had jumped on me about the way I looked. You know, and then when I told him, he was all apologies and all. And he really tried. And the clowns. We just about to get on a plane when five or six of those newsmen come in there, and they never take no for an answer. They keep bugging you and bugging you and bugging you. You know. So finally we got on the plane and got away. When we got to Los Angeles, then, to Travis Air Force Base, and of course my son was there. He was a public affairs officer, and he had them all lined up and told them what they could ask and what they couldn't ask and the whole bit. So that was pretty easy when we got into Travis. They had a set bunch of questions, and he told me what they were going to be, and you know, it was a pretty good operation. But when we left there and flew into Los Angeles, then they were all there again. You know, when we got off the plane, there was a whole slew of them. It was easy for the L.A. and the Orange County paper. I lived in Orange County, so they were right there. And when I got home, we lived in a townhouse complex, and there was big motorhomes parked in the driveways in the townhouse with antennas on them for the TV station and all kinds of stuff. And because we finally got rid of them. And in fact, they were pretty good about it, really. The ones that came to the house, I recognized a couple of them from watching them on television, you know, news reports. And And I said, hey, you know, I said, that's it. I gave him a couple little bit of information. I said, this is all I can give you, and that's it. And then the local paper, which is the Santa Ana Register, they called up and they said they made a deal with my son that if they can interview me, and then they would let him see the interview before they printed it to make sure it was okay, met with the Navy and my desires and whatever. So, but they only they had one little screw up in it, but they did a pretty good job, basically. That was about it. It was kind of a weird experience in a way, but very unexpected.
Yeah, sure. So, I see now that you live in Syracuse. So, when did you move back? So, when did you move back to New York State?
When did I move what?
When did you move back to New York State?
Oh, okay. We let's see. We left Orange County in 70. No, take that back. 85.
Okay.
And we moved from Orange County to Florida.
Okay.
And then we were in Florida until 99, and we moved to Syracuse.
Okay. Okay.
I have family all over the place. We lived in California. We had a bunch of family there, and then we moved to Florida. And I had my daughter there, and then she moved with us up to New York. I have another daughter up here in Syracuse, a daughter and grandchildren, you know, and kind of keep us busy now.
Okay, and of course there's your sister who also lives in New York.
What was that?
Well, and then you also have your sister who lives in New York as well.
Yeah, right, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she's been in New York ever since she went in the order a year after I went in the Navy.
Okay.
So she just celebrated 60 years, I think. Yeah, when she took her final vows. 60 or 65.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. She's been around a while. And she was a teacher for the biggest part of the time, and then she was into finances for the order. She financial secretary, and did pretty good.
Well, yeah, she's doing some good work.
Yeah. Yeah, and when she first went in, it was a very tight order. It was a French order, and it wasn't cloistered, but it was pretty tough. I mean, she wasn't allowed to visit us. We weren't allowed to visit only certain times, and you know, if there was going to be a man in the house when she came to visit, there had to be two nuns with her, and all kinds of stuff. They finally changed that. Right around the time the ship got sunk, they went completely out of the habit. She wears civilian clothes and a whole bit.
Wow.
Things changed radically. They became Americanized. But they used to speak French and everything. You know, they were pretty tight.
So were your parents alive at the time of the collision?
My father was.
Okay.
My father was. My mother had passed away in 55. My father was alive, yeah.
Okay.
And my father, my sister, that's all I had in my family.
Okay. So I've heard from some of the survivors that there were some who, at least for a while, had bad dreams or they might have had. Well, I've heard from some of the survivors that some of them have had, you know, bad dreams, that sort of thing, especially for the first few years after the collision.
No, I think I'm pretty fortunate. I didn't. I know I spoke to a number of them, and no, I didn't have any of those problems. To this day, I still don't. You know, and I talk to some of the guys, and every once in a while they have a nightmare or a dream or something. You know, but the guys that I think that have the most problems with it are the ones that were down below in the engine rooms. They had trouble getting out, and some of them got burned, you know, and different things, mm-hmm. scalded and whatever. So I think they had a, my experience was kind of clear cut, really.
Sure.
It was almost like watching a something on TV. You know? You know, standing there, all of a sudden I open my eyes and there's the water pouring in through the porthole. And I'm standing on a bulkhead and I called out to Wright. I said, Wright, where are you? And he said, I'm out here. That's when he answered me. He was already in the wardroom. He'd gotten out. And, you know, we got hit like a 315, and the forward part of the ship sunk in 3.5-4 minutes. So everything went pretty damn fast. It's hard to put, you know, time on it. But you didn't have much time to react. Other than, thank God I learned how to swim finally. And, you know, as I say, the Australians did a good job on the pickup and all of that stuff, and I had a couple of guys griping about them, but I don't think anybody's really got a legitimate gripe as to how things were handled by the Australians. I wasn't at the final hearing, so I don't know, but I did read the final report. As I say, I had that whole, however many pages that was, 1,200 or 1,300 pages or something.
It's really thick.
Yeah, well, I sent my copy to Texas Tech. They have it in Texas Tech, the final hearing. And then, of course, I read the book that the Australian skipper's wife, Stevenson, wrote. Did you ever read that?
I haven't been able to get my hands on a copy yet.
She started out. She wrote two, actually. I imagine, from what I heard, I didn't read the first one, but the first one was, she was kind of tough on us, but then in the second one, things kind of changed around a bit. I think she wasn't too bad.
Okay. So when you read the report, what was your reaction?
Well, that's when I really first find out that it was really our fault, that we had made a mistake. I say we, the people on the bridge, whatever, had made a mistake and really turned the wrong way. I visualized it when it first happened. We were riding off the starboard beam of the carrier. And the exercise was that whenever they were launching, we would break to the right and do a 180, come around, and actually do a 360 and get in behind the carrier. For recovery in case the pilots went in the water. They were launching. And the night before, when that exercise was over, I got the word, I heard it on the phones, okay, we're secure tonight, there's not going to be any more exercises, we're not launching any aircraft or anything, you know, so I really didn't expect any problems at all. And then when it did happen, I kind of visualized what I thought was, we made a wrong turn and it come out, but I thought instead of making that big wide sweep to the right, coming around behind the carrier, we had made the mistake and turned left, right in the path of the carrier. And basically, that's really what happened, I guess. I don't know. That report was pretty good. Our officers took a bit of shellacking, but I guess justified, so I really don't know. Hard to say, I wasn't there.
Well, true enough. Well, thank you very much.
Well, I'm sorry you had to call back.
That's okay.
In this day and age, my wife's got a bit of a problem with Alzheimer's.
Okay.
So I do most of the shopping and all that stuff, and kind of got to keep things on an even keel. But I've got a good family. I have a daughter here in Syracuse, and her son, and I have my her daughter who lives nearby in Canastota. I've got some grand. I got see one, two, three. I've got four grandchildren up here, and the rest of the family. In fact, the one reunion we went to, my whole family went to the reunion except one. My one grandson's in the Army. And he couldn't make it. We had 33 people at the reunion.
Yeah.
And it's grown since then. There's two more added to it. And we've got a couple more getting married, so I'm sure it's going to end up a pretty good size. But, we have California. Geez, I think we have probably damn near 30 people in a family in California. And mostly in the Bay Area.
Boy, if you brought all of them to a reunion, you'd have to have your own section.
Excuse me?
If you brought all of them to a reunion, you'd have to have your own section.
Yeah, right. I think we had the biggest family group that ever attended one of the Evans reunions anyway. But we had a good time. They're a good bunch. Right now, I got the one grandson still in the Army. He did a tour in Korea, and then he did one tour in Iraq, and now he's back in the States now, and Texas there.
Okay.
He's waiting for orders. I think he's probably going to be transferred to another outfit. But he's the only one that's in the military now. So, because he had to go in the Army, I have to give him a hard time about that. But it turns out his father started out in the Army, too, at West Point, and transferred to the Navy. So a bit of a twist in his family with the Army and the Navy.
So what does he do in the Army?
He's a specialist in driving fuel trucks. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
That's a lousy job. But we sweated that every time we heard a truck or something being blown up there in Iraq. But he made it through okay.
No, that's good.
Yeah, he's going to be a lifer, so he's made sergeant, and he's got a wife and, well, two children. He's got one and one on the way any minute. So, anyway.
Some more additions.
Yeah, adding to the family, yeah. They keep working on it. But anyway, I appreciate your calling.
Oh, I'm happy that you agreed to the interview.
What was your connection to the Evans?
I'm working on my dissertation on the Evans. That's really my connection. I'm not related to any of the survivors or anything.
The name sounded familiar.
Well, I've been to a couple of the reunions, so you may have heard.
Your name is Tidwell?
Yes, sir.
I thought one of our skippers was named Tidwell back in World War II days. Maybe not. I'm thinking of something else. Anyway, the people from Texas Tech, they contacted me. I sent them my copy of that final report. And I've got a folder I have to send to them, a lot of newspaper clippings and stuff from Orange County about the accident. They might want to put in that file.
Oh, sure. I'm sure they will.
Where do you live?
I actually live right here in Lubbock.
Where?
In Lubbock.
I didn't get you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I live right here in Lubbock.
Oh, Lubbock. Oh, you're right there by the university then.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes. Yeah, this.
I hope to get back there pretty soon. I have one son that now lives in San Antonio, Texas.
Oh, that's my hometown.
Is it?
That's where I was born.
Is that right? Yeah, he moved there a while ago. In fact, I've got a granddaughter there that's got a house there. Now my son's got a house there. And he goes back and forth between California and San Antonio. He's in the wire and cable business. But we're going to be getting back there for a wedding, I guess. And when I do, I intend to go over to Texas Tech to take a ride over to Lubbock and see what's happening there.
Well, I'm sure that they'll be happy to take you around on a tour.
Yeah, that's good. All righty. Well, thanks a lot for calling, and if I can do anything else, give me a buzz.
Okay.
All righty.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
You too.
All right. Bye.